Hill Properties LLC versus Landmark American Insurance Company.
Your Honor, may the lawyers and the parties who came for the last argument be excused?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to wait just a moment until the courtroom settles down just a little bit so we can make sure you have full attention. All right, we'll hear first from Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Anderson for Appellant Wharf Retail Properties. This is an insurance coverage case arising from Hurricane Sally. The jury returned a verdict in this case of just over $6.6 million. District court then applied limitations in the policy, including coinsurance and prior payments, and entered judgment for just over $1.2 million. The district court performed those post-verdict analyses without telling the jury that it was going to do so. The district court instructed the jury that cover damages, which was called for in the verdict form, first for breach, then for cover damages, meant how much money will reasonably compensate Wharf for the harm caused by the breach, and that the damages that the jury could award as cover damages were limited by the policy. Those two instructions are extremely important because the judge was instructing the jury to apply the limitations of the policy, including coinsurance and including prior payments. But then, post-verdict, the judge assumed that they did no such thing and applied them again, ultimately rendering that $1.2 million verdict. The most important thing I want the panel to realize about this verdict form: performance of the coinsurance calculation and application of the prior payments was absolutely required to answer question number one: did Landmark breach this policy of insurance? The jury could not answer that ultimate question on breach without performing a coinsurance calculation and considering prior payments, because it was very possible that the application and or of coinsurance and the deduction of prior payments would result in a scenario where Landmark was not in breach because it had paid all amounts to which Wharf was entitled. In fact,
so your argument is that the burden of proof wasn't in the verdict form?
The verdict form didn't properly operationalize the burden of proof. It asked, did Landmark... It's not just a problem with the verdict form. It was what the judge did with it after. If the judge had just allowed cover damages to remain what they were, we would maybe be here on one issue, but most of this would not be an issue.
All of that was in the general instructions to the jury. Everything that you wanted on the verdict form was already in the general instructions to the jury,
except for some indication that the judge was going to apply coinsurance or prior payments again. The jury understood from the general instructions and the verdict form that they, Weeks versus Angeloni from the United States Supreme Court teaches us that we are to presume that the jury followed instructions. Well, here
Did you register any objection to the verdict form before it was given to the jury, or the instructions before the instructions were given to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. First, we proposed an alternative general verdict form. Did the defendant breach, and what was the amount of damages, if so? So that was the first time we proposed the proper way to do this to avoid all of this confusion. The second was at the charge conference. I would refer you to Appendix Volume 8, pages 67 through 80, where we asked for additional questions to clarify exactly what the jury was going to be doing, because the judge was instructing the jury, you need to apply coinsurance, you need to apply prior payments, but then the judge was also asking for certain information that appeared as though she was going to also make that calculation post-verdict.
Those different instructions, but did you register an objection?
We registered an objection in the charge conference I mentioned, but I think this goes to the waiver argument that Landmark has raised. And so there are four reasons that I want to direct the panel's attention that waiver doesn't apply here. The first is that this is not purely an appeal from an improper instruction under Rule 51. It's also because of the procedural footprint that followed the verdict, where the judge went and reapplied these numbers when she never told the jury she was going to do so. We're looking at this also under the Rule 59 standard. Under the Rule 59 standard, we're looking at abuse of discretion and whether manifest injustice resulted apart from Rule 51. The second issue that goes along with that and what happened post-verdict is that the judge ruled on the merits. This was not raised by Landmark in any of the 167 days of post-trial briefing that occurred when first the judge asked, what do I do with this verdict form? I don't know exactly how to apply this, so she invited adversarial briefing on that. Landmark didn't bring up Rule 51 waiver. We filed for a Rule 59 motion, which was ours was denied, and Landmark also didn't press waiver at those points. So this has already been fully heard on the merits, apart from this waiver argument, through that about half a year of additional litigation. The Farley case that creates this the clarity of this waiver doctrine, Landmark cites Parker versus Warden, which is an unpublished version of this doctrine that doesn't address two exceptions. The two exceptions announced in Farley are futility and miscarriage. So futility basically says that we don't need to keep repeating the same objection once our position has been made clear to the court. We made clear to the court with our initial proposed jury instruction and all of the discussion with the court that went on about that, and then again at the charge conference, that this is not going to be clear to the jury as to if they are being told to apply coinsurance and prior payments or not. The judge told them to do it, but then operationalized the form in a way that it was at best confusing and then caused the judge to reapply these numbers. So futility under Farley is satisfied, and then the miscarriage of justice element or exception in Farley is also met. The judge admitted on the record in one of the post-judgment hearings, she said, we know that the jury applied the $1.9 million prior payment. We all know that. That's a quote from...
The jury had the 2020 report and the 2020 report into evidence. And it could, we don't know which one it considered in order to arrive at the total replacement value. They had both of them in evidence. We don't know which one they relied on, do we?
We do know because there's a facial match between what they filled in on one of the special interrogatories and the evidence. And this goes to the third issue raised in our brief, and that is the jury's use of those numbers shows two things. One, that they were fundamentally confused about the purpose of those special interrogatories because both parties had fully disclaimed the use of the 2020 numbers. And it was the 2020 numbers, Your Honor, that made their way to the penny verbatim into the responses to that special interrogatory.
Well, who offered that 2020 report into evidence?
We offered it into evidence through Christine McHugh, the 30B6 representative for Landmark, to show that their pattern of adjustment should take away any credibility.
And so now you're arguing that the jury shouldn't have relied upon the report that you offered into evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, because both sides said that it was not good evidence.
But it was in evidence. I mean, you offered it. It was in evidence. So the jury was free to rely upon things that are in evidence, right? Regardless of what you might have argued how they should consider it, it was still theirs to consider, right?
The document was theirs to consider for what it was, but there was no testimony or any evidence that this was accurate. The only evidence that was adduced at trial is this is an inaccurate report, and this is what we based prior payments on, not the final adjustment. The final adjustment, the final payment is what matters for Landmark's breach. Because they had paid $1.9 million, they would have never paid that $1.9 million under this 2020 report. So the 2020 report is like an old witness statement saying the car was green, when at trial, the defendant says it was red and the plaintiff says it was blue.
Did you try the case yourself?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. During closing argument, you invited the jury to consider the 2020 report?
I invited them to consider as one of the options the 2023 report. So,
did you invite them to consider the 2020 report too?
No, Your Honor. The 2020 report was introduced to show lack of credibility on Landmark, and that was very clear in the questioning and, frankly, the answers by Ms. McHugh, where we went through one by one, yeah, that's a mistake, that's a mistake, that's a mistake, that's a mistake.
But at some point, didn't you say you could accept Mr. Sinicall's valuations as error-ridden and unsupported as they are?
Absolutely, I did, because what we also showed was the 2023 report was error-ridden and unsupported throughout. He relied solely on a technological system that he didn't understand. He couldn't explain.
But by doing that, did that arguably invite the jury to rely on the 2020 report?
So I don't believe so based on what the judge told the jury. The judge told the jury, as we hear in most cases, you were not to consider the arguments of counsel as evidence. And she also created this a bit of an awkward situation where she told us in the charge conference, you just explain to the jury how this verdict form should work. So she created a situation where the jury had no authoritative basis to conclude how this should work because she told them, don't rely on what the lawyers say. It's not evidence and it's not binding on you. And then she told the lawyers, why don't you go explain this? That created an irreconcilable problem where the jury, obviously, as we saw through all of the post-verdict briefing and hearings, didn't understand this and included some.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what happens all the time. I mean, the district judge gives the instruction, which is the pattern instruction, says what the lawyers say is not evidence, and then it's the job of the attorney to argue the jury instructions, the verdict form, et cetera. And when I say argue it, I mean, that's what they're doing. They're explaining it, but they're explaining it in a way that they hope will cause the jury to conclude that they're right about it, you know, that they win. Mm-hmm. So why is that different from what usually happens in a trial?
Well, because what I explained is this is the context of what Landmark has done wrong, and that invitation of the various options they could choose was referring to the 2023 numbers that at least was Landmark's position. Landmark disclaimed any reliance on 2020. They said our position is 2023. So it logically follows that in closing you can say that you can rely on that. We don't think you should because it was full of errors and we demonstrated to the jury what those were. The other piece to this that I'll briefly finish with.
Is this in response to the question?
Yes, Your Honor. Is that I could not find any 11th Circuit case that said that when there is no competing theories, like they point to the O'Loughlin case, but the O'Loughlin case was about competing theories about a piece of evidence. We were actually unified on this 2020 piece of evidence, my friend Mr. Taylor and I, that it was no good. It was not valid evidence. I could not find any authority to say that the counsel's comment in closing that is not evidence could somehow resuscitate a piece of evidence that everybody had disclaimed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Anderson, you've reserved 3 minutes. We'll hear next from Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Wayne Taylor for Landmark.
Good morning.
In my 40 years of practice of law, I think this is probably the first time I am standing up here and having to defend a verdict against my client. If it's okay with the court, I will start with the last argument that Mr. Anderson was discussing with the court, and that is his request that the district court be reversed and that a new trial be granted because the jury may have relied upon Rob Senecal's 2020 report. I do want to again emphasize the fact that it was the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Anderson's client, that introduced the 2020 report as well as the 2023 report into evidence. It was not Landmark that put it into evidence. And during closing, I'd like to read the entirety of the portion of Mr. Anderson's closing argument. And he said, "You are going to be asked about those replacement values on the verdict form. You can do whatever you think is appropriate based on the evidence." Again, evidence that Mr. Anderson and his client put in. "You can accept Mr. Senecal's valuations as error-ridden and unsupported as they are. You can accept what is in the policy and the schedule of values, which is the most appropriate thing to do. Or you could put zero." So during closing argument, Mr. Anderson told the jury, gave them options. And by the way, I didn't hear, and I don't see anywhere in the transcript where he specified Mr. Senecal's 2023 report as error-laden. He said, "You can accept Mr. Senecal's valuations as error-ridden and unsupported as they are." Didn't specify to the jury, didn't tell them, you need to focus on 2023 and not 2020. And I might also point out that there was no other evidence other than Mr. Senecal's two reports that were put into evidence by any party about the replacement values. Now, the standard here, of course, is that the district court is given wide latitude because the court has seen the evidence, has seen the jury. And the district court, while she may have made the statement that we know what they do, I actually stood up and said, "Your Honor, that would be improper because we don't know exactly what the jury did. We don't know how they came to all of their conclusions. Yes, the 2020 replacement values seem to line up, but also the valuations, the actual damages that were awarded by the jury as to the amount of damage caused to each building as a result of Hurricane Sally. We don't have any idea how the jury got to those numbers. I understand that Mr. Anderson, in his briefing, has presented to the court a theory on how that's done, but again, we have to.
It does line up pretty neatly, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's not exact. If you actually do the math, it's not exact. And frankly, if I wanted to take the time, I could probably find a way to make the math work as well. But regardless of that fact, you have to agree and go along with the sanctity of the jury's verdict, and you can't disturb them. And in fact, I'd like to point out to the court, and it was not in the briefing, and I apologize for that, but McDonald versus Pless, which is a United States Supreme Court case.
Have you alerted your opposing counsel to this before the argument?
I did not, and I apologize, Your Honor.
All right. Well, why don't you follow up then with a letter explaining what you're going to explain?
Okay.
Because it's not really not on this, because it's not really fair to opposing counsel.
And that's fine. I can address that later. The jury adopted, or it appears that the jury adopted Mr. Senecal's 2020 valuation, and this all came about because as he was getting ready for his deposition, he realized that there were some errors. And then he was deposed on a new report that we were able to get out before his deposition. Both of those reports were put into evidence. The jury decided which one, based on the three-day trial that went on, which one that they should adopt. So we shouldn't reward Wharf Retail with a new trial because the jury rendered a verdict based upon evidence that it introduced in and of itself. Now, I'd like to turn to the other issue that was raised which is the waiver argument on the jury verdict form. And there was no, in fact, no actual objection. Yes, during the charging conference, there were alternatives that were offered as to how the jury should be charged. There was an alternative discussion about the plaintiff's preference to have a general verdict form, and I explained to the court during that why it was necessary to have a special interrogatory verdict form, which the court agreed with. There was no reason whatsoever to include the actual burdens of proof in the jury verdict form because the judge went ahead and charged them on that already. And there was, it just would have been repetitive, and there was no reason to do that. And she was and the judge, when she charged the jury, properly charged it on the law. And so, and there's no dispute and no argument from anybody that the court failed to properly charge the jury on the law. Their only complaint is not only should it have been in the jury charge, but it should have also, the burden of proof should have been included within the jury verdict form. And there was no not necessary for that. The district court found it was not necessary because she had already properly charged the jury during its instructions and left it at that. And unless the court has some questions for me, I'm not going to use up the rest of my time. I think I've made the points that I needed to make here. And if we'll just allow Mr. Anderson to go through. So thank you, Your Honor, and we ask that you affirm the district court's refusal to grant a new trial on the three bases raised by the plaintiff. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Anderson, you've reserved 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. One point I want to make, that in order to reverse and remand for further proceedings, you don't need to get to the issue three and the question between the 2020 and the 2023 values. The first two questions of the jury verdict form are really what's important to focus on initially, and that is, was there a breach? Yes. What was the amount of covered damages? The instructions given by the court here were that you were to apply the policy limits. There is no debate, no dispute that coinsurance and prior payments are contained within policy limits, period. So the jury, we should assume that the jury followed those instructions under Weeks. So if that was the end of the story and the judge had never undone that and applied it again after the fact, we wouldn't be here on those issues. So what's important is that an objection to that specific part wouldn't have been appropriate until we knew what the judge was going to do. The judge didn't do it until after the trial. Mr. Taylor referenced, we need to go along with the sanctity of the jury's verdict. In large part, we agree. The jury's verdict was, what are the covered damages that were the result of Landmark's breach? Questions one and two on the verdict form. The panel absolutely should consider reversing and remanding to go back to that. What happened after the verdict, post-judgment, did not respect the sanctity of the jury's verdict. The judge knew what she was doing was wrong, but felt compelled by certain law to do so anyway. That is the textbook definition of a miscarriage of justice under Rule 59 and why this needs to go back for further proceedings. The last thing I'll touch on is the waiver doctrine, because I think that's the centerpiece of Landmark's case. As I just explained, I don't think the waiver doctrine really applies to these issues on the jury verdict form, because those first two things would have been fine had the judge not then looked over the jury's shoulder and applied those numbers again. But the reason announced in Farley for the waiver doctrine is to promote efficiency and prevent sandbagging, so that parties don't come back after the fact on appeal and say, no, this was another reason. That's not what we're doing. We explained all the reasons why this form and this approach was problematic, and then this was fully briefed and litigated post-verdict. If anything, the waiver doctrine being brought up on appeal only and not at those stages would be the inefficiency and sandbagging by Landmark that Farley was designed to avoid. That's all I have, unless there are any further questions from the panel.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our next case today is Hunt versus the